Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of the bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to today's History Hack. I have managed to get Alina on a boaty podcast, but there's a reason that she's on a boaty podcast. It's because it's exciting boaty stuff, isn't it, Alina?
It's exciting. It's not typical Chris boaty stuff.
Are you saying that Chris's boaty stuff is dull?
Never. I mean, take it as you please by the tone of my voice.
Okay. Pre-dreadnoughts in the late Victorian era doesn't float your boat then?
No, nothing like that floats my boat. Thank you very much. But this does, okay, funnily enough. Ahead. So we've got Marcus Rediker, who's an award-winning historian and writer who specialised in maritime history. And he's written several books, including Villains of All Nations, Atlantic Pirates in the Golden Age, and The Slavery Ship, A Human History. We also have, because we don't have just one guest, we have two guests. Our second guest is David Lester, who is an author, artist, and graphic novelist, whose historical graphic novels include Prophet Against Slavery and The Listener. They are both here to talk about their forthcoming book, Under the Banner of King Death, which is a graphic novel examining the heyday of Atlantic piracy. Gentlemen, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you, Alina.
Gosh, I just have to say, firstly, we've had to fangirl for Kate Jameson to Marcus since he arrived because she's so excited that we're interviewing him. And secondly, we need to apologise to David because he's in Vancouver and it's 7 o'clock in the morning. So welcome, guys, and thank you for finding a spot with us despite all of our challenges with timing. We tend to think of pirates. When I say heyday of British pirates, I'm thinking like Charles II and that era. But this is not that, is it? This is, we're sort of 50 years ahead of that. So how prevalent is piracy in the 1720s?
Well, Alex, the golden age of piracy consists of three distinct generations of pirates. So in the 1660s and 1670s, we have the buccaneers of the Caribbean, epitomized, I think, by Henry Morgan, who leads a lot of attacks on the Spanish Main.
This is Captain Morgan of the rum, right?
Right. Yes, that is the one and the same Captain Morgan. The second generation is epitomized by William Kidd, Captain Kidd. This is in the 1690s. Another famous pirate from that era is Henry Avery, who had one of the most spectacular captures of prize ships ever and escaped with without ever being rediscovered. But this is the period, the 1690s, when the ruling class of Great Britain begins to turn against piracy. Henry Morgan's piracies advantaged the British Empire, the English Empire at that time. But now they see that piracy is interfering with trade. So the third generation of pirates is the one that David and I have written about in Under the Banner of King Death. They are active in the 1710s and the 1720s. And what's really interesting about them is that this is the point at which the common, ordinary working sailors get control of the enterprise of piracy. And they capture these ships. The ship is the most sophisticated piece of technology of the day. And they capture these ships and they create a crisis, a major crisis in the global trading system that Britain has built. And the response by the British ruling class is to hang these pirates in the hundreds and to eliminate this thing that is interfering with their new global empire.
So we're talking about a graphic novel. We've got history, great, fantastic, love it. However, David is here also with us, who is the artist, who must have, this must have been your dream job here, to actually draw pirates.
Well, I wasn't sure. I never actually envisioned myself doing pirates. I've done a lot of gritty social justice histories, and I think the pirates fit into that category in terms of their fight for a better world. But it was a world that I didn't entirely know. And so I had to do a lot of research on it in terms of, especially visually, what did pirates, what did people in the 18th century wear? What did they drink? Alcohol? What kind of pipes did they smoke? What were their shoes like? What were their hats like? And of course, you have to do it when you're doing a book like this. You have to do it from the working class to the ruling class. You have to have a grasp of what you're going to depict, and hopefully it's as authentic as you can. And of course, the basic thing of what did sailors look like? And because I like to remind people, like 300 years ago, we did not have photography. So the visual representations are down to either crude drawings that maybe people did as sketches, or very sophisticated etchings like Hogarth had done of people in that time period. And so you search as an artist for what you can find in terms of any kind of reference like that. And also, how did people dance? What songs did they sing? And ultimately, how did people talk, again, from the working class to the ruling class? And so that was a source of debate in creating the script for the book, is how much should we be authentic to the time period, knowing that the reader may well not understand the language being used at the time. So after much discussion, we ended up with a bit of a compromise where we would give a sense of how people spoke at the time. And the main thing is, you do not want to sound modern. You want, to take people back 300 years ago and immerse them in that way, to feel they're part of that time period. And so for me, I use a lot of, rough kind of drawing and in order to kind of tell a gritty story. And I feel like the drawings should match the content of the book, and it shouldn't just be, oh, I'm going to draw in a cartoony style that is modern. I wanted it to look as rough as the history that I'm depicting.
So let's start talking then about the kind of material that you were given to work with by our historian in the room. So it's really interesting that I had never considered like an evolution in types of piracy. I always just thought pirates were pirates and that was it. So let's talk about this third phase that you were talking about. So what are the conditions like for an everyday sailor on a merchant, slaving or naval vessel at the time?
Well, this was a period in which the conditions were especially bad. Because the third generation of pirates, this emerges in the aftermath of a war, the War of Spanish Succession, which ended in 1713, which resulted in an international depression. It resulted in sailors losing their jobs. And for those sailors who still managed to maintain their jobs, the working conditions plummeted. People were bilked of their wages by these very powerful captains. The food they were fed on board the ships was really poor in quality. The joke was that the bread on a merchant ship could walk around by itself because it had so much vermin in it. and maybe most importantly, this was a period in which ship captains had the total power to discipline the crew using the cat of nine tails. So floggings were very common in this era. And this combination of factors, the sheer difficulty of the life of the common sailor, predisposed those workers to make the decision to become pirates, where they would be free to organize the ship in any way they wanted. So they abolished the wage and made themselves risk-sharing partners. They limited the captain's ability to punish the crew. They voted on the captain. So they created a very democratic and egalitarian social order. And I think in some ways, this was kind of a utopia for the common working sailor. But the fascinating thing is that this history is significant in its own right, but David faced the challenge of translating this history into images. Like, how do you show the working conditions? How do you show people going through the process of deciding to become a pirate? So I think this is a very important thing that he's done in imagining and visualizing this social world.
And
graphic novel, you have a, you've got basically, you've got a mutiny, which is not something very easy to illustrate. So I've got a two-part question. My first question goes to Marcus. So Marcus, first of all, how common are these sorts of incidents? And David, how did you go about illustrating these mutinies?
Well, in this period that I've mentioned, right after the War of Spanish Succession, there is a massive spike in the number of mutinies. The discontentment aboard the ships is so great. The violence is so great. It becomes, these ships become like floating powder kegs. And so what I was actually able to chart over time, the number of mutinies throughout the first half of the 18th century. And it's in this period when they really do explode and become quite commonplace. And in a lot of those mutinies, not all of them, but in a lot of those mutinies, the sailors, the rebellious sailors decide to capture the ship and set up as pirates. So David, over to you as to how you represent that complicated process.
Well, as an artist, the easy and the exciting part of drawing a particular piece of history is when it becomes, goes into the category of almost like a revolution. And so you have the battle, the physical battle. And so that's great for an artist because it's not cerebral. It's just, depicting people fighting and the visceral factor of blood splattered. And so in that way, you, as an artist, I get the watercolor paint out and I have different methods of splattering it onto the page, onto the drawings. And you're kind of free to basically defy even the sense of what normal drawings are. And so in my case, I often overlay drawings on top of each other. I cut drawings up in order to create a sense of movement to slow the reader down. So they have to look at, in a case of just one drawing, I cut it up in three and they have to look at three little drawings in it. It is a way of trying to give a more cinematic approach to comics, but also to play with the medium of comics in terms of telling a sequential story. And so that's the sort of the exciting part. And the tougher part is to depict actual social change where the pirates reach this point. They've taken over the ship. Now what? And so how do you depict the idea of democracy in action in terms of voting? Because that seems like a very dry thing. And so... how do you do that when you don't have a film? You have to do it with a series of drawings. And part of that is to just let the drawings speak, show the people talking, voting, show their faces, their excitement about what this new world is that they've created. And I felt it was really important to really spend a lot of time trying to get that right in order to not sort of just go to the next bit of action and the next bit of battles between ships. And you have people signing their names to the declaration of principles for what they would be the democracy they were creating on ship. And so so that's all somewhat difficult to do, but I feel like with the book we tried to accomplish that, and I feel like we did, as well as putting the little touches on that ships had cockroaches everywhere. So I have cockroaches crawling up the page. I have weevils, which was in their food, and that's kind of, they're going along there. I have rats all over the place. So you want also to give the reader a sense of that dynamic. This was not just a sterilized life on board a ship. This was a living, living creature, if you want to call it that. And so even though these little things are just side points to it, they're the touches that I think make it a visceral experience for the reader.
It's so cool. I love what you mentioned there. I just want to go back to Marcus because you mentioned social change and the fact that, yeah, I mean, it would be grand, wouldn't it, to just draw loads of boats and loads of battles and action in every scene. But you do have nuances of history to tell in this. So, Marcus, how does piracy in this period affect the British and other seagoing European economies?
Well, in this third generation, in the 1710s and 1720s, I estimated in Villains of All Nations that the pirates captured somewhere around 5,000 merchant vessels. That is a massive number of ships. And so you can just begin to imagine the disruption to the new trading system that has been built, especially, I would emphasize, the so-called triangular trade linking Europe to West Africa to the Caribbean and North America. Pirates had a special impact on the slave trade because they attacked slave ships on their way to West Africa before they had loaded enslaved people, because they liked those ships. They were big enough to hold a large crew. They were relatively fast. And so merchants in London began to complain to the British Parliament that these pirates were really destroying one of the most lucrative kinds of commerce to be found anywhere. And that was the slave trade, which was essential to the building of the plantation system of the Americas and ultimately to the building of global capitalism. So the pirates were in a very strategic position to do great damage to the economy of not just Britain, but the entire Atlantic economy. And I do think this is a challenge for David and myself in terms of how do you represent that challenge. And the way we chose to do that, and perhaps David can expand upon this, is that we created a part of the story in which these wealthy merchants decide to send a pirate hunter after the crew of the Night Rambler. So you get the view from above about the chaos that pirates are causing, as well as the view from below about how these sailors are trying to build a better life for themselves.
Part of making this book is in previous books, I've done things like create clay heads of the characters as a means of drawing a figure from 360 and also controlling the light source with a flashlight. And I've built sets, almost like film sets, as a means of drawing to scale, a way of depicting the story, because in the course of 100 or so pages, that's a lot of drawing to do. And in this book, there's about 700 drawings to make this book. And in this case, one of the main characters was was an 18th century galleon. And so I decided to build one with, you know, I ordered a model kit and stuff like that. But it's to scale, and it's an extremely complicated process. And I had to enlist my partner, Wendy, to help me with this. And luckily, you know, I hadn't built one since I was 10, and she always wanted to build one, but because of gender roles, she was unable to do that. And so she got to fulfill her dream of building a model. And so it took us 7 months. And in the equivalent of that, I realized we could have sailed in the 18th century across the Atlantic. So the ship was an important part of, a part of the story. And it plays the role because we have the ship, the ruling class has their ships that they're coming to get the pirates, and the pirates have their ships that they've commandeered. And so the battle is set up between, in a class battle, really. And so the ship plays an important role in the depiction of it. And because as an artist, you're always thinking of how do you depict the history, and not just tell it from a sterile point of view. And the ship was great because the ships, you know, they're always in movement generally, and they have the masts are up or down. And so, you know, that was part of this process. And it was invaluable to have this ship as kind of the anchor to the story and in telling this kind of class history.
You've clearly taken the history so seriously as the artist on that. And I want to ask both of you, obviously as a historian, Marcus, but also as an artist, David, you mentioned gender roles. There are women in this. How common is it to have women aboard as pirates or sailors, Marcus? But David as well, is there any concerns for you about stereotypes and falling into stereotypes of portraying women, or were you particularly alert to how you styled the women that appear in the graphic novel?
The simple answer to your question, Alex, is that we have no idea how many women were at sea, because most of them disguised themselves as men and worked at sea for long periods of time without ever being found out. If you had asked this question, I'd say 25, 30 years ago, the answer, how many women actually went to sea, as sailors or pirates, the answer would have been none. But now we know that there were hundreds, if not thousands. Some scholars of the Dutch East India Company found a huge number of women who had gone to sea on their ships. So it's a challenge to try to figure out exactly how many people were, how many women were on board. Now, in the golden age of piracy, in this third generation, the 17 teens and 20s, I found four. I suspect the actual number was probably many, many times that. But two of them, Anne Bonny and Mary Read, were actually quite famous in their own day. In other words, they were very well known. They were written about in London, in the colonies. These women pirates were quite famous. Anne Bonny was a wild and ferocious redhead who actually scared her fellow male pirates. She was quite a tough character. But these women actually played a very important role in showing that women too could find freedom under the black flag, that this was that there was a kind of symbolism to this. They were challenging the very heavy masculine gender roles of seafaring, and they challenged it very successfully.
In order to answer that question, I should go back to explain how the script was written. And in the beginning, the book is based on Marcus's book, Villains of All Nations, but he had written what we might call a treatment, an outline of the story. And from there, I took that and wrote a script, much like a film script. So it's all broken down into scenes, numbered scenes, with each one beginning with a description of whether it's, you know, daytime, nighttime, on sea, on land, what characters are involved, and then each character's dialogue is written out. So that was the process. And then I would give the draft to Marcus and Paul Buell, and they would give their changes. And we went back and forth like that over the period of about 3 months. And one of the challenges was how to portray the main character, Mary Read, in the book, because she starts off, she's dressed as a man to take her role as a sailor and as a pirate in the story. And then at a certain point, she does reveal herself to the crew. And that was a tricky thing as to how you would do that, visually represent that, and the reactions of the crew to her unveiling of who she really was. And part of, going for how one might portray that was one of the process of the script is that eventually I got my partner Wendy and I, we acted out the script, and we each had our parts, and that was really instructive to read text out loud for the sense of, did it flow? Did it seem authentic in terms of people's relationships? And also in terms of the unveiling of who she was to the crew. And so my partner Wendy gave me very valuable kind of comments on that, and so that helped with the idea of how we would present this in a way that had that passed, a test of whether it was plausible or realistic enough, in just in terms of human beings, and so again, that reading out loud of the script was part of this process.
So every graphic novel has to have its celebrity. Let's go with the word celebrity, which in your graphic novel is Charles Bowles, aka Black Bart, who has been on our podcast before, not the first time. So talk us a little bit about who he was, first of all, to Marcus, and then David, tell us a little bit how you managed to portray him.
Okay, Black Bart Roberts is the most successful pirate in this early 18th century generation. He captured over 400 ships. He had a fascinating kind of power. He had an entire consort of pirate ships. There were several ships that sailed with him. He was an extremely formidable force. He was the one that the British merchants went after. He was causing all kinds of problems in the slave trade. And his death in battle in 1722, you could regard as a real turning point in the history of piracy, because after Black Bart Roberts was killed, and after 52 of his crew members were taken ashore in Africa and hanged, that really was kind of the beginning of the end. It would take a few more years for it to play out. But the great thing about Black Bart, or one of the many great things, was he had on board his ship a special occupation, which he called the Dispenser of Justice, which meant that when they captured a prize vessel, the pirate crew would line up the sailors of that prize vessel and ask them, "How does your captain treat you?" And if those sailors complained that the captain was vicious, that he cheated them of their wages, that he flogged them, that captain was in a lot of trouble. So Black Bart had a kind of avenger mentality for the common sailor. The other thing about Black Bart is that he was a bit of a dandy. He really dressed very well. He had a bright red feather in his cap. So we thought he was a great figure to include, but he is kind of a cameo in our story, isn't he, David? He comes in as like the most successful of them all to talk to this pirate crew that we've been following on the Night Rambler.
Yeah, he was actually the most kind of fun to portray, even though he's in there relatively briefly, because in my research of him, it's like the pictorial evidence that we have is with the feather and the cap and a kind of very ornate outfit. He was definitely, there's a flamboyance to him, and unusually, and Marcus can correct me if I'm wrong, but he seemed like he preferred to drink tea as opposed to all the drams and the rum and everything. And so that was kind of different, because the rest of the book is pretty rough. And aside from the, you know, the ruling class, depicting the ruling class, when you're depicting the pirates, it was pretty kind of the same in the sense of, you know, I don't think they were so concerned about their appearance, but Black Bart certainly seemed to be. And so there was a kind of an elegance to him that was actually really refreshing to draw. And so that was his cameo was to me a memorable part of the book.
See, in my head now, I'm just thinking of Dustin Hoffman in Hook. Okay. I really want to know. So we've talked about sort of social things and how you portray them, but also things that are even more sort of vague in terms of pinning them down and drawing a picture of them or writing about them or getting them into stories. So notions of freedom and self-determination, and do they catch on in this era, Marcus? And you mentioned the treatment of captains and officers and how they treat their crews. I mean, are we seeing an evolution here with how people are treated at sea, and how do you draw that?
Yeah, good questions. Yeah, I think, first of all, I should say that the ideas and practices of democracy and equality that we have treated in this book do have a very long afterlife and are connected, for example, to the American Revolution. Some of the founding ideals of the United States actually have specific linkages to sailors and pirates and the practices that they pioneered on board their ships. So I think there is an important story here. And I just might mention that the next graphic novel that David and I are doing is about a major uprising in New York City in 1741, in which John Gwynn, the pirate who is the sort of lead figure in Under the Banner of King Death, comes back as the leader of an Afro-Irish conspiracy to capture the city. So we will, in our next book, talk about the continuity of these radical ideas further forward into the 18th century. Your question about did things change over time? No. Captains did not treat their crews any better. That's because piracy was put down with great violence, these mass executions that I've talked about. If you had sailed into practically any Atlantic port in the 1720s, you would have seen the corpses of pirates dangling there in gibbets, in chains. And we do have actually a very powerful image of that that David has drawn, very important to the book. So pirates would frequently use their last statements, usually on the gallows, to offer a criticism of the way ship captains treated their crews. And they basically would say, and we begin the book this way, if you don't treat us better, we're all going to turn pirates and we're going to fight back. So this becomes part of the ethos of pirates, kind of who they were. This is part of their social conscience. This is part of their image of a better world, fighting back against this unjust authority.
Okay, David, previously you mentioned crude drawings of pirates. I'm actually, to be honest, I wanted to bring that up a lot earlier, so I'm quite excited to get to bring this up now. Only because I also want to see these images of these crude drawings, so I'm getting overly excited just over crude drawings. Sorry, let's get actually back to the question that I want to ask you. So the images of pirates have obviously changed, or haven't they changed, over the past 300 years through popular media and fiction? And has that affected it? I mean, how did you find challenges in actually drawing these and finding the right sorts of methods and the right sorts of depictions? Where did you go with this? You could have gone left, right, center, behind, and then all the way around again, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, of course, I had to go back to find whatever I could from 300 years ago during the time of pirates. And there are some, you know, depictions of them that done by by what I would maybe call non-artists. And then there are the more sophisticated, stylized versions of pirates. And a bit fanciful, perhaps. It's unclear whether it's really that's really the way they look like. There's a couple. There's one of Mary Read and so you took it. I took it with a grain of salt. And there are no, as far as I'm aware, paintings of pirates. So we rely on whatever etchings there were at the time. But then, you know, we go forward, to the 20th century, and we see how pirates were depicted in Hollywood in the 20s and 30s and 50s. And when television came in the 50s, there was a series on depicting pirates. There was also perhaps the best depiction was in comic books in the 50s by EC Comics. They had a series called Piracy. Beautifully done color work, and perhaps the most honest in depicting the lives of pirates. And the thread that kind of runs through it all is I feel a sense of the portrayal of them is one of admiration to a degree of positiveness about the pirate as rebel. And it feels like that is, even if the depictions are wrong in terms of the history, the idea that these are admirable people, I feel that comes through the depiction. And so as an artist, you have, again, as I said, no photographic evidence. You just have to rely on these sources. And I had to take a little bit from all of them in order to create my own version of it. So, you know, this is what you do as an artist. You are creating a representation, and it is from you as you know, how you feel it's most honestly possible to do. You know, that's what I went for. So there's certain kind of things of how they looked, and they wore scarves, or they had, you know, stripes were part of their outfit in terms of sailors. But, you know, there's more depictions of the ruling class. And so that was much easier to depict how they probably actually look, because there are portraits of them. And so that was part of the process of trying to draw a book like this. It's very complicated, and you hope you get it as right as possible, but you hope that the intentions are accurate and that the history is accurate.
Well, I mean, one of the great things about this collaboration is that, David, reads the history and respects the history, and that is really crucial. He does his own research. He looks into the material culture of the age, as he's already mentioned, how people looked, how people dressed. He then begins to draw people, but then he's working with me and I've been studying this time period for 40 years. So there's this interplay between the historical knowledge and the artistic production, which I think is really important to this, this kind of work.
So am I going to be disappointed that they're all not going to look like Jack Sparrow?
You know, they're much cooler than Jack Sparrow. This is a case where the actual history is much better than the Hollywood fantasy.
Okay. I just want to finish off, and I suspect this is one for Marcus mainly. I want to ask, you've mentioned sort of social change and what you're going on to next and how it ties in with historical events. Like, pirates are fun. Everyone loves a pirate. Everyone likes reading about pirates. People like dressing up as pirates. But there is so much importance, as we said, social, cultural stuff embedded in this as well. Because Chris has put the last question is, why do we need this? Why do we need this graphic novel about pirates? And why do we need to know the actual history? Because it's not just fun, is it?
Well, look, a crucial development of the history of piracy took place in 1887 when Robert Louis Stevenson published Treasure Island. And once he did that, pirates entered the imagination of children. And then along came Peter Pan. And then came this raft of Hollywood movies. So, I mean, I've been writing about pirates for a long time. And when you start to talk to people about this subject, you can see in their eyes that their memory of their own childhood is at stake. Like, what were they really? I've only just imagined them. So this is the kind of foundation, I think, of the tremendous interest around the world in pirates. People, it's almost an obsession. People are so fascinated with pirates. And they don't know the real history for the most part, but they do have a sense that the rebelliousness of pirates is something that they admire. David alluded to this earlier on, and let me illustrate this by talking a little bit about the meaning of the image that is behind David, the skull and crossbones. Okay. This is the famous pirate black flag. It's called the Jolly Roger, right? Well, in the 18th century, Roger was a cant term, meaning a term of the underground, of the poor, of the criminal world, of the kind of dispossessed proletarians. And Roger basically meant to fuck. So when pirates put up a black flag, the message was, fuck you.
That's brilliant. I love that. I mean, we still use that in Britain. We do still use that as a term. Anyway.
This is one thing that people find very powerful about pirates. They stood up to the most powerful people of their era who wanted to kill them, each and every one, wanted to annihilate them. Mm-hmm. The wealthiest people in the world wanted to destroy these pirates, and the pirates looked them right in the eye, and they laughed. They said, we'll have a merry life and a short one, and to hell with you. So this actually gets back to those social justice themes that David mentioned earlier.
I wanted to add that I feel like as the world appears to be lurching towards authoritarianism, I feel like our book is a completely contemporary and relevant story, and that it's a reminder of a time when people on the bottom rungs of society rose up and acted collectively against all odds and created a democracy. And so our book depicts rebellion in action. And I feel like that something that it should be an inspiration to modern day activists in the fight against exploitation. And finally, you know, the book is a depiction of a resistance to tyranny, and it displays the long, powerful, noble history of that conflict. And pirates are an important part of that history. And that's, again, going back to why would we do this book? Well, because it is a contemporary story in reality, because exploitation and authoritarianism hasn't gone away. In fact, it is always there with us. And so it's always good to have a reminder like a book like ours to where we sit in history.
And in a medium that is so much fun as well, I think.
Yes, exactly. Because I find when I've talked to history teachers, they find that some students are unable to read longer texts. And so graphic novels have become extremely important in the process of teaching history and social justice history in particular. And students are very, or young people, I should say, are very much attuned to text and visuals together. And so graphic novels accomplish this. And so students are very open to this as a medium and very attracted to it and want to, and part of the process of teaching is to have students do their own graphic novels. So you can see it's somewhat of a democratic form. It's not intimidating. And that's a great thing. That's really, it brings people in to exploring history that they may have thought was, oh, you know, too dull and boring to deal with, but we give it into a context that is really quite, understandable and also inviting. And that's the nature of graphic novels.
Do you guys remember that test you used to have to go through in school where they found out what kind of learner you are, you know, visual, listening, and all sorts. And I know loads of people, very smart people, who just can't read long text, and being able to read a graphic novel or listen to a podcast or even listen to a book has helped them a lot and has helped them understand certain things in history. And I find these sorts of mediums really great, especially for young people who are finding it more and more difficult to be able to sit and read a whole book or a academic book or anything. And that's why we do what we do, is to be able to bring history to other people who might not necessarily be able to pick up a book and read the book. Instead, we give them something they can listen to. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. I found this so, I'm so happy I didn't have to listen to boat things.
But well, you did. We found a way to make you do boaty history without you realizing you're doing boaty history.
Exactly, because pirates are actually fun.
Yeah, and what we have to do is throw in rum, murders, gibbets, and then you'll sit through it without complaining.
Crazy red-haired ladies too.
Absolutely. Guys, congratulations. This book is out at the beginning of next year in America and in the spring in the UK. Is there anywhere people can pre-order it now?
Yes, it practically every bookseller. It's listed, okay. Online, any online seller, you can find it.
So under the banner of King Death, do go. We'll put a link. I'll find a link for a bookseller that is not Amazon, because Jeff Bezos has got enough money. And we will, hopefully bookshop.org have got it. So we'll put it on there and we'll put a link so you can pre-order it, because I think a lot of people will be very excited to see what you've done.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Our incredible guests give us 45 minutes of their time to join us and talk about their work or their new book. This is just a small taster. As a result, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest books, you can support them, and you can support us on History Hack. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep going and bring you more top-of-the-line guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/History Hack, or search for us in the shop section. Thank you so much for your continued support. We really appreciate our listeners and supporters. So make sure you get down to the bookshop and grab yourselves a new book.